You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This is the last cowboy song, the end of 100-year wars. The voices sound sad as they're singing along, another piece of America's lost.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. We are taking a break from our ancient history sort of side shows and moving into something much more contemporary, that is country music. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. And joining me today, we have two very special guests. On my right, not that that matters for anyone who's listening, we have Danny Anderson, assistant professor of English at Mount Aloysius College in Crescent, Pennsylvania. Danny, are you actually an assistant professor? I just said that.
I am, yeah. I could have probably applied, but I was just kind of overwhelmed and I didn't feel like doing it this year.
Don't want that extra cool $1,000 a year, Danny.
I was just, after the last year, I was a little exhausted and just wanted to take the summer to read comic books on my front porch and whatnot. And so, yeah, I'll probably try next year. We'll see what happens.
So. You know, I didn't actually know that. So if you want the promotion, I can reread it as Danny Anderson, associate professor of English at Mount Aloysius College.
No, I'm from Cleveland. That just jinxes it for me. And so we're very pessimistic about the future.
Sure. I think there's an ESPN 30 for 30 episode about that, about how like miserable every sports fan in Cleveland is.
I had a professor in graduate school who described Cleveland as burned out and beautiful, like a Twilight Zone episode.
Not bad.
That's good.
Not bad.
Well, that other voice listener that you heard is Michael Farmer, assistant professor of English at Crown College in Saint Bonifacius, Minnesota. I knew I was going to mess that up, Saint Bonifacius.
But you messed up the saint, not the Bonifacius.
I mean, I'm a Protestant. Come on, how often do I actually say the word saint?
Nice.
I invited these two to join me in part because they took part in the country music episode that the Christian Humanist podcast did years ago now, right? It's been a while since you guys did that.
Yeah, I was.
It was when Danny was guesting, so.
Yeah, that was, 2013? Something like that? Yeah, a long time ago.
Because Grubbs was writing his dissertation, I think, is why we had you in for that semester.
Right. Well, anyway, you guys had good things to say, and I wanted to leech off of that for the City of Man. We should dive into this so we don't spend too much time on this background stuff. I want us to just briefly go around and talk about our personal backgrounds with this. When did we first run into country music, and who are any favorite artists, least favorite artists that we sort of listen to or refuse to listen to, as the case may be? Danny, why don't you lead us off?
Oh, yeah, and so if I repeat myself from that Christian Humanist episode, forgive me, I haven't listened to that since, or ever, actually, so since the day we recorded it, so I don't remember what I said on that day, so if any of this sounds repetitive to that, I apologize, but I don't ever remember a time without country music. My family's all from West Virginia, and they had moved to Cleveland before I was born, part of that migration that Dwight Yoakam actually documented in his song Readin' Writin' Route 23.
They learned reading, writing, Route 23 to jobs laid waiting the city's factory. They didn't know that old highway lead them to a world of misery.
Mine was Route 21, but at any rate, it led to Cleveland for me. But my family brought it with them, country music, so that's all we ever listened to in the house. And I remember my dad had 8 tracks of Johnny Cash and Buck Owens and that sort of thing. So that was the era, the kind of style of country music that I grew up listening to the most. And then as I got older, I added non-country music to that repertoire, but as I never lost my love of country music, and so I sort of went more into the roots of the stuff that my dad introduced me to, and so I feel like I have a pretty good appreciation for the history of that genre, and so yeah, that's kind of where I came from, came to it from.
Okay. Favorite artists, least favorite artists, or you just like it all, or?
Well, gosh, my favorite. I mean, I love Dwight Yoakam. And he's sort of my favorite. Rodney Crowell is another big
sure.
of mine. I love Rodney Crowell, and so that kind of troubadour style, I guess. I've really been into Willie Nelson again here lately. I've been listening to Redheaded Stranger a lot this week. I don't know why, just to get myself in the mood for this maybe. But yeah, so that kind of outlaw / neo-traditionalist genre, those are sort of my favorite.
Michael, how'd you get into it?
Well, like Danny, I don't remember ever really not knowing it. My first musical memory is actually Willie Nelson singing some country song. I don't remember which one. It's kind of a vague impression of the voice. I didn't really listen to it myself when I was growing up, though. I don't really know why. It was the new era. It was the Hat Acts of the late 80s, early 90s when I was growing up. So I came back to it through the alternative country movement in the 90s, early 2000s, the Americana movement. And we talked about that, I think, quite a bit on our country music episode. And I'm sure we'll talk about it here in a later episode when we get to that era. But that's the way I came back to it. And since then, I've gained an appreciation even for the Hat Acts, who at the time seemed like the worst thing that could possibly happen to country music. And I'll tell you, listening to the country station today, I would give anything to hear Garth Brooks.
You know, I like you guys, I don't remember when I started listening to country music. It was just sort of always on the radio when I was growing up. I don't think my parents ever listened to anything else other than maybe some of the contemporary Christian music. Can you use that about music during the 80s?
I think that's what it was.
I think that's where that term comes from.
I thought that had started later in the 90s, but other than maybe some of that, and even then it still had sort of a country sound. There was definitely some connection to it. So it was always there. And then at our family reunions, all of my grandmother's generation, like all of her and all of her siblings, all knew how to play instruments, so they would bust them out and play basically every night at our family reunion. So it was sort of always there growing up. But my most vivid memories, I went to Garth Brooks's farewell concert in 1998. It's the first concert I sort of intentionally remember going to because I wanted to go and sitting through the whole thing and enjoying it. And then 7 years before that, I had gone to the Judds farewell concert.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, man.
I don't know if they count as a hat band or not, since they're
no, and I don't think they're really neo-traditionalist enough to fit in with that movement. They were much poppier. Wouldn't you say, Danny?
I don't know. I kind of feel like the Judds were one of those groups that were, you know, going back to a much more simple arrangement, and so I mean, I feel like that felt like it was akin to what, say, Randy Travis and folks like that were doing. When you say Randy Travis, of course, never wore a hat, so I don't know if.
But I think Hat Act is a kind of derisive term to the neo-traditionalist country. Alan Jackson, Michael Montgomery.
When I use the term neo-traditionalist, I guess, somewhere we have to get our term straight then. I think of like Steve Earle, Dwight Yoakam, Lyle Lovett, Randy Travis. That's in the sort of
And I wouldn't put Travis with those guys because he's so much poppier. I would call those guys Americana, maybe.
I think,
or even alternative country, if you think that term has any real meaning.
There were definitely proto versions of that, I think.
Yeah.
That's what I always associate neo-traditionalism with in the kind of mid to late 80s, right about to the point where Garth Brooks steps in. And then I always called it just pop country, but,
I think pop country is probably a fair term too. And all of this is a spectrum, right? So I would say that Dwight Yoakam, of everybody we've mentioned, is probably the closest to actually reviving an older style of country.
Yeah.
Although it was a defunct style of country, right? It was the Bakersfield sound instead of the Nashville sound. So it was a style that no one had been doing, and 20 years.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, Merle Haggard was making records the whole time, and I think he even had some hit records in the 70s. But, I mean, it is true that a kind of glossier country took over in the early 80s, although I don't really know that much about that era.
Your Crystal Gale and that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's the era. The radio stations I always grew up listening to, that was the kind of country we were used to hearing. To me, I mean, Dwight Yoakam's Guitars, Cadillacs, etc., the album that has that famous song on it.
Girl, you taught me how to hurt real bad and cry myself to sleep. Show me how this town shatter dreams. Another lesson about a naive fool that came to Babylon. Found out that the pie don't taste so sweet. Now his guitar's Cadillac, hillbilly music.
That was like a watershed moment in country music. That was like, this is like, I, you really, it sounded so country, it didn't sound country. It's the strangest. And so to me, that was a big watershed moment for me, and when I really started to love country music.
But how much of a line is there really between that song and Chattahoochee by Alan Jackson, for example? I mean, both of them have that kind of rock guitar sound. Alan Jackson's a little glossier, but I mean, Guitars, Cadillacs is not. You wouldn't call that a punk song. I mean, it's pretty glossy.
It's pretty dangerous, though. I don't, especially live performances with his tight pants and suggestive bouncing around the stage, and like he was definitely in the face of country establishment, I think. We're jumping way ahead, of course.
Yeah, we really are.
7 episodes down the road.
No, this is great, though. This is why I wanted you guys on.
But it is important, I guess, to get the eras named. So we're at least using the right term, the same terms. Whatever's right, right. Doesn't, I guess, matter.
So I'm fine calling the Hat Axe pop country, if that's what you would prefer, and we can save neo-traditionalists for the likes of Dwight Yoakam.
Okay, that makes me happy, at least.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, the end result of this Judd's farewell concert that I went to in 91 was that I could not tell you anything about the Judds at that concert, but their opening act was this new guy on the scene named Garth Brooks.
Oh, how funny.
I think the general consensus, I was not that old when this is going on, but talking to people who were older at the time, the general consensus is he kind of blew everyone away, and the Judds were there, and it was their farewell show, but no one really cared after he'd performed.
So. Did you guys ever hear that Cocaine and Rhinestones episode about the Judds?
Uh-uh.
Not Holy crap. That is a crazy story.
Yeah, they're very dysfunctional.
I don't think dysfunctional begins to cover it. And then you hear about poor Ashley Judd, what Naomi did to her. Anyway, that podcast, Cocaine and Rhinestones, makes what we're doing here irrelevant to begin with. But that episode in particular is just amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, listener, you should go listen to the Cocaine and Rhinestones. It's a good show. Our advantage over them is we're a little more systematic. He's just kind of doing whatever he wants to do topically. And it's interesting and well done and all of that. But we're going somewhat historically, I guess. But yes, it's a good show and you should go listen to it.
He is also the son of David Allan Coe, who was one of my favorites when
is
I was
really?
7, 8 years old. Yeah, Tyler Mahan Coe.
Ah, that's David Allan Coe's son.
So I said I didn't like country music when I was growing up. I guess I didn't like it when I was a teenager, because I remember in elementary school I was actually quite into it, including that that Alan Jackson song, and I loved David Allan Coe.
Yeah,
just loved him.
His his sort of outlaw country stuff before he started getting. I guess it's okay to sound like a conservative on City Man, but before he started getting really foul, like his earlier stuff is, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he put out a couple of underground records that I don't think anybody can recommend.
No.
Yeah. Proto alt right. I mean, they're very vulgar and kind of culturally hideous, aren't they? But yeah.
Well, and not even musically worth it. Right?
Yeah.
It's not like it's great music. It's just vulgar for the sake of vulgar. Which I guess we should maybe talk about what is country music? Why are those unacceptable when maybe in other genres they would fit right in? What is unique about country? And Danny, can you kick us off with that? What is country? What makes it different from everything else out there?
I think that as we go on with these discussions, it'll be apparent that it's really hard and a kind of an impossible task to define country music as a particular collection of instruments or a particular style or vocal stylization. To me, the way I kind of think of country music is more along the ways the Americana genre defines itself now. It's a pretty diverse genre, actually, but it settles in on the distinctiveness of a particular place, right? There's like these regionalisms, and so that's something in an ideal definition here for me, that it sort of comes out of the organic stuff of a local culture, right? And it isn't mass produced from the top down. This is a kind of music that ideally is developed in a community of people over a period of time.
It's traditional.
Traditional, right? And so it's and that's why it can transcend stylistic genres or boundaries, because it's not really about what kind of musical instrument you're playing. It's about the experience of like local places, right? And so I think, as you'll see as we start talking, the idea that country music is not so much, I guess it's not so much a style. It's more of an attitude. I guess that's not the word I'm looking for, but it's rooted in kind of lived everyday experience, and it's less about a product to be sold in an ideal form. I mean, that's why pop country sucks now, because it's totally the opposite, right? But the kind of country music that we're going to be talking about in appreciative ways are very kind of working class poetry, if you will, that is rooted in particular places and the experiences of particular people across a variety of regions. And so it's going to sound quite different depending on what the regions are, but they all share this kind of humanity in their kind of just love of community and their kind of addressing tragedy and whatever the topics are about. It is about living real life, I think.
Isn't all good pop music, I just mean not classical music, isn't all good pop music about real life and basically about working class people? I mean, folk music certainly is, most rock music is, even jazz, which to the degree it's about anything, because a lot of it's wordless, right, seems to me to be about the concrete struggles of the subaltern.
Well, and I think that's where I would just want to nuance Danny's definition. Danny, you're not wrong, even though I wrote explicitly on the outline Danny Anderson is wrong.
The notes that I would be wrong. Yes.
Yeah, you're not wrong. But the nuance I would want to throw in is country is all of those things. It's traditional and it's local and it's working class and it's all of that stuff. But it's all of those things in a rural setting, right? So it is claiming to be the music of the country. Not the music of the inner city, which, of course, you can be local and you can be working class and you can be poor and you can be traditional and rooted and all of that in an inner city. But there's a different kind of music for the inner city.
I think generally that's probably true.
I
do think, though, that one of the distinctions I want to make later on when we start talking about political aspects of this genre is folk and country are kind of difficult to disentangle, and I think folk is much more located in urban areas, particularly starting in the 50s, and so I think that's one place that idea gets a little complicated. And actually, I think it expedites the distinction.
The other thing that we haven't really mentioned yet is that country music is overwhelmingly white. And I think that's an important part of this. I mean, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but you can definitely count on one hand the number of famous black country singers. And one of them is the guy from Hootie and the Blowfish, so I don't think he counts.
Yeah, yeah. Just because of the era he's singing in, I don't think that's actually country music anymore. But yeah. That's not a genetic distinction. I think in the roots of country music, there is a lot of cross-pollination between African-American music and like hillbilly music, if you will, right?
Absolutely.
And that's a distinction that arises as the genre develops and probably has something to do with the marketing of records.
White and black music separate and converge multiple times over the course of the 20th century. So, I mean, you think about rock and roll is equally white and black in a lot of really important ways. And then, 10 years or so ago, maybe 5 years or so ago, there started to be a rap influence on mainstream country music. And there you see them converging again. But still, overwhelmingly, it feels white to me.
Mm-hmm. Undeniably, yeah.
Right. Well, and again, I think that is in part because of where it's located, right? Inner city versus rural America, which is not to say there are no minorities in rural America. It's just not the place we tend to think of first.
And I think in rural African American communities, we just started calling that music blues, and we started calling this music white people were singing country, right? And
yes, so, right. Well, and all the rural black people who were playing music moved to Chicago, and all the rural white people who were playing music moved to Nashville.
Yeah,
so.
True. That's a good point. Yeah.
Well, and that may be a good place to jump into sort of the next topic, but I don't want to do that unless if anyone has anything to add. Anything else on what country music is other than an amorphous, indefinable blob?
As long as we're okay, just being okay with that complication, that's all I wanted to get out of that conversation. Yeah.
Well, Michael, can you talk to us a little bit about sort of the origins and influences on country music? And here we're going to focus in kind of historically, sort of leading into the 1950s. So everything prior to 1950, Michael, what do you got?
Sure. And when I think, actually, Danny's description is very good, because I think really what we're talking about is music that begins as Appalachian folk music. And you can see that very strongly in the country music of the 1920s. They're covering these Appalachian folk songs. A group like the Carter Family, I think you would probably call them folk artists if they didn't have Southern accents. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So you begin there with the kind of simplicity and storytelling and finger picking of Appalachian folk music, and from there you add a little bit of blues, you add in some cases a little bit of jazz. You think of something like Western swing, that's basically jazz music if it were right. Black people instead of white people playing it and there wasn't a fiddle up front. So one example I like to use is, I think it's Jimmy Rogers's Blue Yodel number 9. I think it's number 9, you know, he numbered all his blue yodels. Blue Yodel number 9 is him singing to a blues construction featuring Louis Armstrong on trumpet.
Standing on the corner, I didn't mean no harm. Along come a police, he took me by the arm. It was down in Memphis, corner of Beale and Main. He says, big boy, you'll have to tell me your name.
So the question to ask yourself when you hear that song, is it a country song? Is it a blues song? Is it a jazz song? And the answer, of course, is the distinction doesn't exist yet. And I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind, that all of our distinctions are ultimately at least somewhat arbitrary. And of course, all these different genres of music are influencing each other in noticeable ways, just like the rap that would come into country music in the 21st century.
Yeah, which is exactly how culture just sort of works, right? As different people, groups come into contact with one another, cultural sharing just happens, right?
Wouldn't you call it cultural appropriation, Danny?
Well, I have a whole show about that. But I think that that's one of the misnomers of that, that is always a bad thing. I mean, it's amoral. It's not good or bad. It's just a natural outcome of people intermingling, right? And seeing something that they like or is useful and importing it into what they do. And so I think that musically, that's what you're seeing in these Appalachian areas in the years after the Civil War, when you had white and black people sort of living together in communities without a lot of the distinctions that we have today between race, right? Poor white in African Americans, I mean, it wasn't the same kind of political environment that we have today, right? And so there was a lot of cultural sharing, and that's the result is this music that eventually becomes called country music. But when you listen to Jimmy Rogers, for example, as you brought him up, I mean, it doesn't sound really any different than any blues songs that you might listen to from that time.
That's right, except he has a hillbilly accent.
Yeah, there's no real difference except he has been enjoying a kind of music played by his neighbors, and he's singing it in the way he sings it, right? And that synthesis, you know, incorporates these two different cultures at the same time.
And that's one thing I find helpful about, and maybe unhelpful, about the label Americana music, because Americana music demonstrates the degree to which soul, blues, folk, country, even jazz are all bound up with each other in ways that you can't really disentangle them except arbitrarily.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I think we all know country music when we hear it.
Yes, eventually, now. But if you were to play Jimmy Rogers to somebody now, it would be interesting to see how many people would identify it as country music, or would they put some other kind of label on it, because it was still developing at that point. That's, yeah.
In fairness, at the Jimmy Rogers point, I don't know that you can really say we have a independent country music yet. We're still in sort of the formative stage where all of the origins are coming together. And I don't know, one of the reasons I outlined this episode for, you know, kind of up to the 1950s is I think until you've got both commercialization on the national scale and the rise of television, you can't really separate out what Jimmy Rogers is doing from what's going on in other, we can't even really say genres, right? What people are doing in blues and jazz and so on.
Well, I mean, there is. When does the Billboard charts? When do they start?
Oh gosh, I don't even know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
because I mean, at that point, you definitely have genres emerging because they and I mean, they're arbitrary and they're commercial genres, but they're developed in order to determine who's playing what to what audience, right? So they have the race records, and I think they even called them hillbilly records.
It's called hillbilly music, until that term became kind of, you know, non-kosher, right?
But hillbilly music is also different from country, right? It has different subjects. It has a different feel to it. I mean, it is one of the major influences on country. But if you're listening to hillbilly music, it does sound different.
Yeah, so when I'm thinking about the stew, I guess that eventually becomes something definably known as country music, Jimmy Rogers is definitely one, and the Carter Family is another one. I was doing some thinking about this today. I sort of made a little outline, and this is really not scholarly or anything, but this I think is just a helpful template. And there's lots of variations that, you know, can challenge this. But Jimmy Rogers, this kind of more kind of urban sound, given that it sounds kind of like blues, right? You have that
singing brakeman.
Yeah, that.
So he's going from urban center to urban center.
Yeah, so you've got that against the Carter Family, which is right out of the mountains, right out of the hills. And there's not, it's not a guitar driven music. It's more like fiddles and banjos and that kind of thing, right? And Bob Wills and Texas Swing. Mm-hmm. You've got that kind of influence arising out of a totally different culture, and Bill Monroe and your sort of traditional bluegrass music, right? And so those four things eventually share enough they create something. They are the basis. They are the roots of a tree that eventually we can identify generally, generically as country music, right? And, but they each sound very different from each other. If you listen to a Bob Wills record next to a Bill Monroe, bluegrass song, I mean, they don't sound like the same genre at all. But together we sort of now recognize them both as the roots of what we call country music.
So here's an interesting thought experiment. Play Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grinelli or Grappelli or whatever the fiddle player's name is. Play that next to Bob Wills and ask somebody why one is country and one is jazz.
Yeah.
Because it's the same instrumentation, it's the same sorts of chord progressions, and yet Bob Wills is almost instantly recognizable as country, and Django Reinhardt is almost instantly recognizable as jazz music.
Well, I think one other factor. So I like the Carter Rogers Wills Monroe combo. But one other thing that, in some ways, I think sets them apart from later, more defined country music as a genre, is they are all specifically Southern, right? And from a somewhat, I mean, they're Texas or they're Appalachians. I guess I don't remember where Bill Monroe is from. Is he from Kentucky?
Kentucky,
yeah.
Yeah. So I know Jimmy Rogers never performed north of the Mason-Dixon line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's from Meridian, Mississippi.
Right. So but even in terms of his concerts, he never went farther north than D.C., which of course is at that point still a heavily Southern city. The influences, the stew, that's a good word too. Again, in the early days, the origins are almost all poor and Southern.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's probably right, because that's where a lot of that's where the migrant communities come from that will eventually carry these styles to Bakersfield, California, to Chicago, to the places that they go for economic reasons, of course. These migrations carry these things from a source, and that's the place people were leaving was Appalachia, right?
Right.
And the Plain States and those sorts of places, right? Where these local communities, which had been kind of isolated from general America, become kind of their own little cultures, and then they get dispersed out and bleed with other cultures.
Maybe. By 1930, how many blues artists were from north of the Mason-Dixon line? Do you know what I mean? Or even jazz artists in the 20s and 30s, well, the 20s anyway, are mostly Southern, are mostly Louisianan.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't know when things kick off in St. Louis and in Harlem. I know they do eventually, but I don't know when that starts.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're right, because, I mean, like, Duke Ellington is Harlem, and he's in the 20s. St. Louis jazz, there are definitely St. Louis jazz musicians in the 20s, although I think mostly that's a 30s phenomenon.
Well, and I think St. Louis does count as south of the Mason-Dixon line, too.
Yeah. But I take your point. I mean, I do think the southern part of this is important, if only because it gives them a common accent or a more or less common accent.
Well, right. And it's I think one of the reasons that, again, one of the reasons I like the 50s as sort of the dividing line is this kind of music, whatever we call it, this proto country, it's not really national yet, right? It's still regional, and you know, you talked about country as rooted in a place, and I think that's always true, but it's still rooted in a specific part of the country. You certainly don't have the cowboy imagery quite added in yet. Right, you don't have the western side of things. You don't have the rural New England stuff. It's coming, and it's on the way. Jimmy Rogers, I think, is one of the people who starts that. But until you get Roy Rogers and Gene Autry and some of those later additions.
The singing cowboy kind of type, right? Yeah.
When is Wilf Carter? He's Canadian, too, I think. I mean, he's an early singing cowboy. And then I was thinking about, like, the yodeling records from the 20s. I mean, how much is that? How much of that do we need to take into account when we're coming up with the roots of the genre?
And that comes from a more Plain State era, because it's about, like, cattle. I mean, it's rooted in sort of, like, ranching, right? I mean,
yeah, that was a big Jimmy Rogers thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, of course, the blue yodel. I didn't even do a joy.
Yeah, I don't know how much there was before him. I mean, I think there was some, but I think he's the one who really injects that in.
Yeah, that's fair.
And it goes away. I mean, how much... I would love to see, you know, Toby Keith try a yodel just for fun.
I think for some reason I'm thinking that Kacey Musgraves has a song where she yodels on her new album, but I might be making that up.
Yeah, I'm going to be totally ignorant when we get to country music after about 1998. I mean, I'd totally given up on it by then. And so, yeah, I've heard the names of some of these folks, but
yeah, there's a couple that I listen to, but not many. So,
yeah, I mean, I utterly shifted to Americana, which is sort of, I guess,
hipster's country.
Maybe that's it. I mean, that's it. But it also feels like it feels more, here's that word, authentic, but it does feel like, it doesn't feel like an entirely commercial enterprise. It feels like these are people telling you, making art out of their lives, right?
That's country music for people who don't own televisions.
Well, Steve Earle calls modern country music, I heard him in an interview call it, hip hop for people who don't like black people.
That's great.
I think that was a pretty good estimation of it, though. So. Yeah. But in these, another thing to note, though, in the different styles we're talking about is kind of vastly different instrumentations, where you have a guy and a guitar leading some forms of this. You have a band, not really with a guitar, but with fiddles and banjos. That's a different sound. And then you have swing orchestras, on the other hand, right, who sound entirely different too. So these variations on instrumentation that come out of the local cultures and traditions, right, they're kind of introduced into these variants of the proto country music, that, and then they all kind of unite to kind of make a classical country sound, I think.
So we've got blues and jazz and hillbilly and yodeling and variations on instruments. Anything else on origins or influences? Is it relevant? And maybe this isn't. I should have thought to put this in the outline so we could have thought about it a little. Does it matter at all what doesn't influence it? So I've been sort of reading about this. I didn't read, for example, classical music.
Yeah, I was going to make a joke about Chopin being the father of country music.
Right. They're not listening to, you know, Wagner or Beethoven or Chopin or anything like that. Does that matter at all, or is there no way to answer that?
I think it gets back to what Danny was saying about it being blue collar, fundamentally blue collar. This is not. I'm not using this as a value judgment. This is not high culture.
Yeah.
This is what Dwight McDonald would call folk culture. It's not mass cult, hopefully. But it is folk culture. So, I mean, it's the opposite of high culture in some ways, but not in a bad way.
Right. Yeah, and for me, you know, my distinction is I love the low and the high, anything that's against middle brow, right? That's sort of my... That's
you really got to read Dwight McDonald, Danny.
I do, yeah. That's probably where I internalized this from. I did in grad school, but yeah. Because that's the whole sort of New York intellectual shtick, though. But the idea, though, that this is something... then that isn't part of a commercial enterprise primarily, right? This is something about real people's emotions, expressing them with the tools they have in front of them. And those tools were inherited from these traditions. So in the mountains, you have this Scotch-Irish influence. That's, you know, sort of my own kind of background. And the instruments that were brought over from those countries, mixing with the kinds of instruments that freed slaves are now playing in those same areas. And that's what sounds like, you know, hillbilly music or bluegrass in those kinds of areas. And so I think that's what's excluded from that are the things that were associated with, like you said, with high culture and just generally commercial culture, because they didn't have any money to buy this stuff, right? And so they were just using the tools of inherited traditional low culture.
Although, of course, the ones we know about did play for money, right?
Right. Because otherwise, we wouldn't know about them.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes. Okay. That's not what I mean, though.
They're not created by a marketing machine.
Yeah. They were
taken advantage of by a marketing machine.
They are artisans who own the tools of their own labor, right? In other words, right? They are earning their own keep, and they're not sort of laboring for somebody else. They're traveling around to various dances and that sort of thing and playing this music as a way of making living. I mean, and
so country music is a distributist enterprise. Is that what you're saying, Danny?
You know, well, and it's
G.K. really... Chesterton would have liked country music.
Henry Ford did too, though. Ironically, I have something to say.
He loved square dance. Yeah.
I have stuff to say about that later. But yeah.
By the way, it occurs to me that we left out two important influences. Number one is the church. We forgot hymns.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And so much of the structure of early country music is the structure of hymns. And then the other thing we left out is Cajun music, about which I know almost nothing. But I know that it is developing in the 1920s alongside the other streams we've talked about.
Yeah, it incorporates like the accordion out of the French influence, right? Yeah,
right.
Exactly. And so Zydeco and these kinds of subgenres that we have now, that's where they have their roots for sure. Yeah.
That was my grandmother's instrument of choice, by the way, the accordion.
I love accordion.
Play.
Anything else on origins or influences? Otherwise, we should move on to. We've sort of touched on this already. The question is sort of politically then, who does country music speak for, right? We've mentioned the working class, we've mentioned rural, the poor, and so on. But I think we also have to take into account the substance of the songs, right? What not just who are they claiming to speak for, but what are they speaking about? And maybe I'm reading too much sort of my stereotype of 21st century country into this, but is country music all about God, country, and mother? Or is there something more to it than that?
Oh, gosh. I think there's definitely something more to it than that. I think country music at its worst may be about those kinds of things, right? Those are kind of generic American ideals, and they...
Well, it's an American genre, though.
Yeah, but what it does is it ignores local concerns, right?
I believe you're forgetting about a little person called Keith Urban.
He is a little person. No, no. Actually, I was watching the Marty Stewart show, which it's over now, too bad. I actually got to visit a couple tapings of that show, which I love that show. It was on RF.
It's a great show.
Yeah, I was on two tapings of it. I saw the Sturgill Simpson episode right before he broke and became famous, and a guy named Pokey Lafarge, who does like old-timey 20s music, which is really kind of awesome. And so I was at the tapings of those. And Keith Urban was on one of those, not that show, but he was on another episode, and he for some reason ended up with Waylon Jennings' guitar, and he's playing one of Waylon Jennings' great songs, and he just could not pull it off. He just didn't have the gravitas.
Bummer.
To pull it off. So yeah, so what I think is left out of the God, mother, and country thing is that most of the country music that you actually will identify as country is thematically very dark, right? I mean, it's all about losing your truck and your dog getting run over and divorce and alcoholism and jail, right?
Murder. And, do not forget murder.
Murder songs are huge, right? And so country music isn't necessarily this like celebratory genre. It's a mournful genre as well. And so I think that in its religious influences, it has every bit of Lamentations as it does any other book of the Bible there, and even some Ecclesiastes, I think, thrown in. And so I think that the troubled life of a working class person is a primary concern of a lot of country music.
So God is dead, the country is in flames, and mother's a drunk.
I don't hear a heavy nationalist streak in country music until later in the 20th century. I'm racking my brain to think of a jingoistic country song from the 20s or 30s.
I don't know about the 20s. I guess the war era, certainly there's going to be some, right? So once you get into the 40s,
I'm sure they exist. I just can't think of one.
Right. Yeah, the first, earliest one I could think of would be some of Merle Haggard's stuff.
No, that's the 70s. I mean, that's not even early Merle Haggard.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think. That nationalist streak is reactionary more than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point.
About the time the murder songs start disappearing, the country songs start going up, the nationalist songs.
Unless you think that we're sticking something on country music artificially, the murder songs, I mean, all those like folk songs that...
they're all Scotch-Irish.
Yeah, the bluegrass.
Women being killed.
It is, it's... Right. They're all that's native to the genre. I mean,
Pretty Polly.
Yeah, and so these
Danville Girl, Brownville Girl.
I can't remember all of them, but yeah, that is something that's kind of natural to the genre. And so, yeah. So who are there for, I guess, is the ultimate question.
Right.
They're for people who are living hard lives, I think, generally speaking, and who don't have a lot of money. And so they're not buying records per se. These are music to be consumed probably live at first. And then,
radio.
And then through the radio and places like that. So for the working class, I suppose.
So how does that – so all of that is what if you guys have heard Malcolm Gladwell's podcast on country music called The King of Tears, which is – I don't know about the rest of his show. I don't know if it's any good or not, but that episode is excellent. All of that is sort of his big point is country music is, you know, specific, authentic, sad, all of the things you just mentioned. How does that differentiate it out from urban music? When I worked at Borders, the section was just urban music and kind of rap and hip hop and everything was thrown in there. I lack the musical chops to tell you what the difference between rap and hip hop is. So if you guys want to do that, you can, but
hip hop is a culture, rap is a style of music is what I've always heard.
Yeah,
that's okay. I which it was all in the same section because, you know, it was a music store. But how then is that different than what's going on in that genre?
It also seems
very sad and lots of murder and.
Well, I think country and hip hop actually have a great deal in common, socially speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in the South, most of the people who listen to country also listen to gangster rap, or at least they did when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if authenticity is really the right thing to be looking for here. And Tyler Mahan Coe makes this point in one of the episodes of Cocaine and Rhinestones. And I should say he really takes offense at that Malcolm Gladwell episode for reasons he doesn't actually go into. So I'm not exactly sure what his problem is because I enjoyed the Malcolm Gladwell episode. But I think when you break this down to authenticity, you're asking for trouble because at what point do you have to live the life you're singing about? How poor do you have to be?
Right.
How Scotch-Irish do you have to be? I mean, I think when you start talking about authenticity, you run into the same sort of problems you run into when you start talking about cultural appropriation, which is all of this is inauthentic in some way or another. They're all performing. So maybe, and I can't remember if Coe says this or not, but I'm going to suggest that maybe believability is the bigger issue, and maybe believability is a bigger issue in country music than it is in rock music.
Hmm.
Nobody cares if you believe Boston. You know, maybe that's a bad example of a rock band, but nobody cares if they mean it. But your country singer needs to sing like she means what she's saying.
And so, yeah, when you think about the kinship between hip hop and rap and country music, who are both of those genres offensive to? But this kind of middle brow consumer who wants to just buy products and be happy and think that America is awesome, right? And so both of these two, at their heart, they're kind of like guilty consciences, I suppose, when we're talking about country music that is sad like this and hip hop that is sad like that. They both function as accusing, they're almost like radical critiques of society, both cases, because they point out the kind of problems that the system that is making the middle class very comfortable is built on the backs of other people. And this is the other people saying we don't like it, and this I'm very sad about having the system built on my back, right? And so I think that that's how I you're right, authenticity is always a terrible word to go to, and I think what you're exactly right, Michael, what we're really looking at is maybe something more akin to depth and
or specificity, maybe.
Yeah,
and that's a point Gladwell makes, because he compares whatever song it is that Emily Harris wrote about Graham Parsons after he died. He compares that song to Wild Horses by the Rolling Stones and points out how much more specific the Emily Harris song is, which is absolutely true. So, I think specificity might be key, but then I think specificity is probably the key to any good song.
Or any good piece of art. I mean, if you're looking at a great short story, what stands out are the way little things are described and paints the picture in your head so that you can share in the experience, right? And
so,
I think
so. I do have one theory here, and you guys tell me if I'm way off on this. I think what country music does best when it's at its best is it takes words that anybody can understand and expresses feelings everybody has in a way that nobody had ever expressed them before. And I think that is something country music does more than rock does, more than hip hop, because hip hop's not simple for the most part. The lyrics are very complex, very complicated, but country music, ultimately, the lyrics are usually pretty straightforward's not the right word, but they're simple, but they have depth underneath that simplicity.
Yeah,
do you think that's reasonable?
I do. Yeah, and the great country music has craft to it, right?
Yeah,
I mean, a George Jones song is a well-crafted way to destroy your heart, right? I mean, it's like he knows every little detail, or whoever writes those songs, the way he sings them, knows every little detail that is there for a purpose, and that purpose is to destroy the listener, right? And so, yeah, I think that that's exactly right.
Purpose is to destroy the listener.
In a good way. in a good way, yeah.
Anything else on the specificity side of things? I still don't. We've talked about these similarities with hip hop. Is the difference really just the setting and the race of the people involved?
And the complexity, like there's just no such thing as a simple rap lyric that's good. I mean,
right.
I mean, rap has more words per song than any other genre. It just has to. Right. So I think that's a big difference. Other than the setting.
Right, and there's obviously an improvisational quality sometimes to rap that
yes.
country usually doesn't have. I suppose there are exceptions, but none spring to mind.
Yeah, it's a composed sort of music ultimately,
right.
Compared to jazz or hip hop,
which means it's singable by the common people who by the fandom, right? I mean,
yes,
people go to bars and sing their favorite Merle Haggard songs with him, right? And so
I've done it myself.
Yeah. So it's transportable in that way. Yeah.
Well, and that may be a place where country music is more popular, but not in the sort of Billboard sense, right? Populist, I guess, right? It is. Much like, and I'll try to avoid going too much on this tangent, but much like the difference between sort of traditional hymnody in the church and contemporary Christian music, one of those is designed to invite you in, to encourage you to sing along, to encourage you to experience the emotions and the theology by actually participating in it, and the other is there to encourage you to sit and listen. Right, to experience the worship and the emotions and the theology and so on by hearing someone else perform it. And maybe that's another distinction between country and rap. Country is there to sort of drag you into it, whereas rap is there to perform for you. That may be unfair.
I've never been to a rap concert, so I don't know. People must sing along with the hooks, genre. Right?
I do, you know, and being from Cleveland, you know, I grew up, you know, with rap as well. And I think that I definitely know that teenagers rap along with their favorite songs, right? And it is, but yeah, it's, I guess they're the ideal audience for it though. So I don't know how to answer that.
Just because the three of us can't rap along with the song.
Yeah. That doesn't, it's not accompanyable.
The three of us ought not rap along with the song, even if we can.
We'd be the Leastie Boys. So.
Jeez.
So one last thing, since we're pushing up towards an hour, I'd mentioned in the outline, and Michael, you've already pushed back a little bit on this, that one of the challenges that country runs into is that it is regional, right? It is certainly in its roots, as we've talked about, it's deeply Southern, all through the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and really doesn't break out until the 50s come along, which we'll talk about in the next country episode. That brings with it all sorts of limitations once it is something that's now a national phenomenon. Is that an accurate way to talk about some of the problems country has? It's singing to a nation, but it's singing stuff that at least originally was primarily relevant to only one part of the nation.
If that's the problem country has, it's got to be a problem rap has as well, right?
Sure.
I don't know. I think it would take a long time to diagnose what the problem with country music is. Maybe ultimately the problem with country music is the problem with pop music in general right now. I do think you don't want to overstate the regionalness of country music, because in the 90s, for example, the number one radio station in New York City was a country station. So, I mean, I don't know who's listening, but somebody in New York City, lots of somebodies in New York City are listening to country. So I think we have to understand it as being something that is regional in a way, but is also not regional at all, that's also universal, at least among Americans, maybe, among white Americans. I don't know how many black people listen to country music.
And it's also true that people from other countries do love, like, country music as well, right? There's, like, a British fandom for country music. And, I mean, Elvis Costello did a country album, right, Almost Blue. Right. And it was just an album of country covers. And then in addition to the original country songs that he's – so it's something – and he grew up – his dad was, like, a jazz musician. And he's this famous – emerges from the punk new wave scene in England, right? And so
– But he's not a good example, because he's done an album of literally every genre there's ever been.
But it's true, but he had, like, friends that were participating with him, right? And so there's something about – there is something – I mean, I guess anything – any work of art – I guess let's think about Flannery O'Connor. People who are not from Georgia still get something great out of Flannery O'Connor, because she is so true to the details of her culture and her religion and all the themes that she's interested in that – specificity becomes universally appreciated and recognized, right? And so West Coast rap in the 80s was a big thing, and a lot of people across the country could identify with the plight of places like Compton and because of NWA and things like that, right? Because they were so true to their experience in their art that it became meaningful to people. It was a way to communicate that to people who weren't experiencing it, right? And so I think that when it's done greatly, I think it will transcend its regional interest.
I certainly don't disagree with that.
And I keep we keep going back to this hip hop comparison, which is, I think, really interesting. Because one of the stories I wanted to tell when I was looking into this is, so, you know, Henry Ford did a lot to promote, like, square dancing and, like, country broadcasts of country music and stuff.
He's the reason everybody has to square dance in middle school.
It is. That's literally true. And the Ford Company, I read this statement by them, basically, Henry Ford and country music. This is written by Ford Motor Company. And it's just, Henry Ford's love of music started early in his life when he began attending dances, blah, blah, blah. That's not really the reason. I mean, you think about Detroit and in the era of who's working at those auto plants, but migrants, right? Both black and white, okay, from the South. And they're bringing these various cultures. Henry Ford was a raging racist, okay? And so one thing he actually wrote, many people have wondered whence come the waves upon waves of musical slush that invade decent homes and set the young people of this generation imitating the drivel of morons. Popular music is a Jewish monopoly. Jazz is Jazz is a Jewish creation. The mush, slush, the sly suggestion, the abandoned sensuousness of sliding notes are of Jewish origin. He thought jazz was a Jewish conspiracy to corrupt the good white people of the world. And so one of his motivations for promoting country music was as this sort of cultural bulwark against people of color, basically. I mean, there's no other way to say it, Jews and people of color. And so I think that it's interesting now that we're finding so many similarities between these two things that he thought were polar opposites. And I think that the similarity philosophically is about them standing against, like, the main tide of American culture and standing up for their local experiences and fighting for it. And when it's done well, it's great, great art in both cases.
Yeah, agreed. And I mean, that is not true of all art forms. Rock and roll isn't really that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what's his name? Summertime Blues, Eddie Cochran. Yeah. I don't know where he's from. He could have been from anywhere, and the song would still make just as much sense.
Exactly.
jazz, I think, has that a little bit. But jazz, because it is in its way so close to classical music, I think has a universality to it built in, that it's not necessarily coming from some locality. About the only thing other than country and hip hop that I would ascribe that to is indie rock from the 1980s. Think about how important it was to the Replacements or Husker Du that they were from Minneapolis. Yeah. They couldn't have been from anywhere else, right? Or REM in Athens.
Yeah.
Or I'm blanking on any other bands. But I think that's the only other time in pop music I can think of where you come from really matters that much in terms of the actual music.
San Francisco in the 60s, probably.
Yeah, that's a right. good that's a good example.
But yeah, but again, those are the more timeless examples of their genre, right? And they're the more transcendent examples of their genre. And I think that that there's a good reason for that, because they are rooted in real people's real experiences.
Well, with that, I see we are coming up right on an hour, and I do want to get some recommendations in before we go. So we've been sort of talking in big picture stuff. And a little bit about the pre-1950s. Future episodes will be much more specific because we'll have a more specific, tangible genre to deal with. So as we get into the 50s, we'll be able to talk things like Hank Williams and Johnny Cash and so on. But any recommendations for listeners from the sort of pre-1950s stew, which I'm going to keep using that. That's a great phrase. So obviously we've mentioned a lot of people, but any specific, you know, albums or songs that you would encourage people to go pick up and listen to?
Gosh, someone gave me an album once in grad school. My friend Wells gave me this album called The World is a Monster. And it's a compilation of old kind of dark themed country music that is very traditional. And I think most of them are kind of pre-50s recordings. And if you can find that album, it's really a great document, I think, of a lot of what we're talking about here. This is not of that era, but it harkens back. The Carolina Chocolate Drops are a great band.
An African-American band.
African-Americans who play, and if you didn't watch them play, I think I discovered them on the Marty Stewart Show, actually. I think they performed an episode of that. But yeah, they play jugs, they play fiddles, they play very traditional music that even country music has gotten rid of for decades. But they, I think they stand almost as a testament to the fact that the racial lines that we've drawn on these styles of music are rather arbitrary and historically grounded. And if you go back far enough, you can see a point where they disappear. And I think that their project is largely about that. Their music is really just like great songwriting, great covers of other things. And it's a great example, I think, of this kind of amorphousness is what we're talking about here. Those are two that I have that come to my mind.
I can't recommend Jimmy Rogers highly enough. I suspect you can get every song he ever recorded on the 78 collection on archive.org for free, because it's all gone into the public domain. If that stuff sounds too old for you and you're afraid to start there, Merle Haggard, one of Merle Haggard's very best albums, is called Same Train, Different Time, and it's him singing Jimmy Rogers songs and telling stories about Jimmy Rogers. It's incredibly charming. So if you're afraid to go back all the way to the 20s stuff, maybe start with that Haggard album, and that'll give you a way into Jimmy Rogers, if nobody else.
And I'll echo the Jimmy Rogers recommendation. He's a good proto country listen. His music is good, even if the recordings aren't always, given the technology of the time. I'll also recommend Bob Wills.
I was going to say Bob Wills. That's the happiest music anybody's ever made.
Yeah, and if you just can't get into the dark side of it, I mean, his Texas swing is it's excellent.
Take me back to Tulsa. That's such a great song.
Oh, I really like Home with the Girls in the Morning. I don't remember which album it's on, but I saw a Willie Nelson cover it once, and it was also really well done. Part of me really wants to recommend the Carter Family also. I don't enjoy their music.
I don't really like them that much either.
Yeah.
Do you like them, Danny?
I do. Well, I mean, I do, but they're super important for what we call Americana. They're the
sure.
They used to be actually called No Depression Music, based on a Carter Family song, right? And so the Uncle Tupelo covered No Depression, and the whole genre became No Depression Music. And so they're like super important to this revitalization of the traditionalism of country music that we now call Americana. But yeah, but they are not necessarily like a. It's like listening to Shostakovich or something. It's difficult. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. But yeah. I should spend more time with them than I have.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure the problem is me and not them.
Yeah.
I interviewed for a job once in Bristol, Tennessee, and they were like, oh, this is the birthplace of country music because the Carter family was from here. And Victor Records brought down their recording stuff and recorded them. And so I went home and tried to listen to some, and I couldn't do it. And honestly, I think Johnny Cash's stuff with June Carter is his worst stuff. So maybe that makes me a terrible person, but
Jackson. Interesting. All right.
Yeah. I really hate that song.
I'll tell you this, and maybe this will get us some hate mail, but I like Johnny Cash less every passing year.
Oh,
so I'm sure we'll get there when we talk about the '50s, but I just don't find him that impressive as a vocalist.
Well, yeah, let's hold on to that and say I could.
I'm saying that as a Kris Kristofferson fan, so I don't know. Maybe I'm an idiot.
Right. I don't necessarily disagree with you, but I'll defend Johnny Cash later. What was that? There's another recommendation I was going to make. I've mixed thoughts about recommending Woody Guthrie, but he is certainly an influence, right? Especially on those 50s country singers. Once we get to that, and honestly, the country music related to World War II, I don't know if there's a single album that includes all of it. But both the dark and depressing side of country music that deals with some of the fallout of the war, and the side of it that's, you know, we're going to go wipe out Germany and Japan. Both of those are worth listening to, because you get sort of the full force of both sides of country music that down the road will sort of blend together. I'll throw up some links in the show notes. Anyway, thank you guys for coming on the City of Man podcast. This has been a lot of fun, and I hope we get to do it again soon. I have no idea when this episode will drop, but it should be in the next few weeks. I want to get this out before Ken Burns' documentary.
Can you believe what President Chelsea Clinton did today?
What'd she do?
Right. Yeah, I think some of our Rome episodes are going to get bumped back for this. So some of those will drop in 2019, and we recorded them in 2017. So anyway, thank you again, guys. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please do check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or shoot us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This is the last cowboy song, the end of 100 year wars. The voices sound sad as they sing along. Another piece of America's lost.